The following is a presentation of Open for Business, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship's conference for business students and business professionals at the Urbana 06 Missions Convention, held in St. Louis, December 2006. For more information, please visit ofb.intervarsity.org. The tone you will hear in the middle of this segment marks a brief gap in recording. We apologize for the few seconds of lost audio.
All right, our next speaker for this afternoon is Jeff Van Duzer, and he is the dean at the School of Business and Economics at Seattle Pacific University. He is also the associate professor of business ethics and business law. Before working or being appointed to Seattle Pacific University, he spent 20 years in law, practicing with the international law firm of Davis, Wright and Tremaine, and he is a graduate of the University of California undergrad, and he received his JD from the Yale Law School. He and his wife, Margie, have two sons who are probably the same age as many of you, 21 and 23. So with that, please welcome Jeff Van Duzer.
Well, good afternoon. I must say right at the beginning that I am incredibly honored to have been given this opportunity to speak with you. It is a great privilege to be associated with Urbana and its long, long history of fine work and mission. And it's also a great privilege to be associated with something that's brand new, this Open for Business track. And so it's a real privilege. It's also an incredible honor to share the platform with Bill Pollard. I know many of you know, but he's really one of the few names that you've heard for a long time that has thought deeply about the intersection of faith and business, and who's also at the same time been running a very large and successful company. So for me today, this is I stand before you humbled and honestly a little nervous, but also very excited about this topic of business as mission, or how we might think of how business can contribute to God's mission in the world. I thought at the front end I probably should tell you a little bit about what I don't think I will talk about. Sometimes when you talk about business as mission, what people have in mind by that is that you can get money, make money in business, and give it to the church, which is actually doing God's work in the world. And while I think it is part of our calling as Christians to support the church, that doesn't really tell us very much about business. I could tithe as a bank robber. And I'm interested in business. Others, when they talk about business's mission, talk about it as creating a platform that enables us to share our faith with our coworkers. And again, if done in reasonable ways at appropriate times, I think that's terrific. Indeed, we are all called to give account for our faith in all circumstances of our life. But again, it doesn't tell us very much about business. Still others, when we talk about the business's mission movement, speak of business as the way into societies that are otherwise closed to the gospel. Companies or countries that don't want missionaries but are happy to have foreign capital. And again, if done with integrity and authenticity, I think this is a terrific strategy. And there are many, many fine organizations that are working on these kingdom business kind of activities. But still, it seems to me, it doesn't tell us very much about business. What I want us to consider this afternoon is how the nitty-gritty business aspects, the day-to-day things we do in business, the setting up supply chains, the addressing customer complaints, dealing with vendors, hiring and firing, capital allocation decisions, branding efforts, decisions as to when to contract and when to grow, these sort of nitty-gritty business decisions, how is it that they can intrinsically, not instrumentally, but intrinsically advance the work of God's kingdom in the world? Or if you want a mental picture of this, I'd like us to think about if God were to sit down and write the mission statement for business. I mean, you know, corporations all have mission statements these days. But what if God were to write the mission statement for the institution of business? What would he identify as the purpose? Now, by and large, I don't think we've done a very good job as Christians in business really defining this. This is driven home to me every year. I get to, as the dean of this business school, get to teach once a year one course. That's our capstone business ethics class for seniors. So these are students we've now had with us for at least a couple of years in the program. And early on in the class, I like to give them a hypothetical, just kind of a little bit a la Dickens' Christmas Carol. I say, supposing I was visited by three visitors. Only in this little hypothetical, there are three students. And I say to them, the first one comes to me and says, Jeff, I'm thinking of being a lawyer. Why might God want me to go into law? And I say, oh, that's easy. God cares about justice, and if you were a lawyer, you could help administer justice in the world. Second person comes to me and says, Jeff, I'm thinking of being a nurse. Why might God want me to go into the health professions? And I say, oh, that's easy. God cares about healing and wholeness, and if you were a nurse, you might contribute to the health of your community. The third student comes to me and says, Jeff, I'm thinking of going into business. Why might God want me to be a business person? And I say, ah, that's easy, because God cares about, and then I stop, and I say to the class, how should we finish that sentence? And there's always, in every class, you know, there's always a few that are kind of the quick hands up. And it's always fun to watch this one, because their hands shoot up as always, and then just as quickly come down. And I've never really drilled down on this, but I'm willing to bet that as soon as we started talking about business, they thought the right answer was money. And then, oh, no, Christian business school. No, that can't be right. And, and so it leads us into a discussion about what are God's interests in the world that can be furthered through business activities. Now, I remember talking with my dad about this. My dad is a mild-mannered professor of electrical engineering, kind of a quiet, unassuming sort of guy. And I was trying to explain to him that our faculty was wrestling with this question of the purpose of business. And as I was talking, I could see him getting more and more agitated. And finally, in a very uncharacteristic way, he interrupts me. And he says, Jeff, everybody knows what the purpose of business is. The purpose of business is to make money. Or as we like to say in a slightly more sophisticated fashion in business school, to maximize return on shareholder investment. But indeed, this is the dominant understanding of business that operates in our world today. Almost all public corporations would espouse it. Most private corporations would. It is the understanding, the model, the statement of purpose that animates and fills up the curriculum of most business schools. That the notion is that business exists for the purpose of increasing wealth that can be given to shareholders. Now, I would like to suggest to you this afternoon that that is an inadequate understanding of the purpose of business. And I'll go further. I would suggest that if we were able to look at God's mission statement for business, we would not find maximizing ROI on there anywhere. And finally, let me be so bold as to suggest what I think we would find. Two purposes. First, the purpose of business is to produce goods and services that will enable the community to flourish. It's an external focus. We might think of it as aimed at customers. And second, the purpose of business is to create jobs that enable people to express their God-given identity through meaningful and creative work. That's an internal focus. And that those are the purposes of business. Now, if I'm right, that means that a corporate manager trying to make a business decision, considering various options, will not say in the first instance, how is it that I can maximize the return to the company? But rather, we'll say, how is it, after I think about the resources that my company has, that I think about its core competencies, how can I best deploy these in a way that will serve the community by providing products and services that will enable the community to flourish, and serve my employees by providing these meaningful, creative jobs that will allow them to express their identity? And those are different questions. Now, I've had the privilege of giving this thought or talk in other settings, and I've learned now that about at this point of the talk, there's a number of kind of critiques, objections, questions that begin to emerge. And so actually, for the balance of my time with you, I want to respond to four of these critiques or objections. This is a little bit like question and answer time, only you don't get to ask the questions. So the first question that I typically would get is this. Where do you get this idea? Where does this come from? Are you claiming that there is scriptural support for this? And the short answer to that is yes, that is what I am claiming. But usually they want a slightly longer answer. And so let me tell you in as short a fashion as I can why I think we can find these purposes embedded in the sort of fabric of Scripture. If you're interested in developing a theological or ethical underpinning for business practices, there's a number of ways that you can approach Scripture. From my standpoint, the way that I have found most useful is to try to stand back and think of the big picture, the big story, the grand narrative, if you like, which, as you know, unfolds in three movements: creation, fall, redemption. And each of these three movements, I think, has a lot to tell us about the how and why of business. But since I'm particularly interested this afternoon in why, the purpose statement, where I think we need to spend most of our time is in the creation account. And the reason I say that is because in the creation account, which is very short, just two chapters, chapters of Genesis 1 and 2, we get hints, and they're only hints, but hints of the way God set this whole thing up. What God's perfect intent was for our world and for the role that we as human beings were to play in it. So that's what I want to do for a quick moment here, is to look at those two chapters, Genesis 1 and 2. Now, we could draw, of course, lots of principles from this, but let me just highlight a couple that I think are relevant for our purpose. First, notice that human beings in the creation account are not only created, as is the rest of the created order, but they are also called. They're the only part of the created order that gets a calling. They are created, but they are called. They are given a vocation. They are given a mission. They are given a mandate. Now, certainly, a big piece of the vocation is just relationship. And I don't mean just, is relational. That's at the heart of it. And you get one little glimpse of a beautiful picture of a God who comes down in the evening when the cool evening breezes are blowing and walks amiably with Adam and Eve chatting in the garden. It's kind of a hint of a picture of that. But it highlights the relational aspect of the calling. But there is also a calling to tasks. And in fact, you can go through Genesis 1 and 2 and just kind of rattle off the tasks that are being assigned to human beings at the beginning. They are to be fruitful, to multiply, to rule over the earth, to subdue it, to guard or protect the garden, to till or work the land, to name the animals. And we could take this kind of constellation of tasks and kind of put it in a big circle and call that, as some theologians do, the creation mandate. This is what God was calling human beings to do in his perfect plan. Now, the next question is, if that's what the sum total of the initial calling for human beings was to be, what piece of that, if we are human beings working through business, supposed to be delivering on? Obviously, the whole creation mandate doesn't necessarily fit business. Very obvious example, when he says to Adam and Eve to multiply, to have children. That's an activity that's much better housed in the institution of family than in business. Some of you may think that government, with its coercive powers, is probably better able to have the primary responsibility for guarding the garden. It may be that universities, with their structure, have a better setup to be primarily responsible for the classification and basic research associated with naming the animals. But there are at least two aspects of the creation mandate that business is particularly well-suited to deliver on. The first I would call fruitful tilling of the ground. We're called to be fruitful, and we're called to till or work the ground, putting them together, fruitful tilling of the ground. If you go through and look at those first two chapters of Genesis, what I think you will see is that God set this thing up to be perfect, but not to be perfect like a picture, like a static end game. In fact, the Garden of Eden was set up to be a perfectly resourced setting that was all that was needed to unleash a dynamic flourishing. And that was God's intent, that there is to be this dynamic flourishing that comes out of the garden. Now, certainly that was population. Adam and Eve were told to multiply. Presumably their children would have children. The population was to flourish. But the garden itself and its productive capacities were also supposed to flourish. In fact, you get that sense all through it that the garden was to flourish alongside with the population and thereby be able to provide for the needs of the population. Now, here's the most amazing thing about God's initial design. God set it up so that the flourishing was conditional upon human beings stepping in and doing the work. He says, it's a little hint again, but in chapter 2, verse 5, we're told that God creates the fields, but there are no crops yet. Why? Well, one, he hasn't sent the water, but two, because there is as of yet no human beings to work the ground. The actual productivity, the flourishing of the land was dependent on human beings stepping in. Now, this is astonishing. This really, and you could quibble with the word exactly, but in an essence, Adam and Eve were set up to be co-workers with God, to sort of help this perfectly resourced setting really flourish, reach its capacity, and continue. And they were co-workers with God. Now, he didn't have to set it up this way. God could have done it a different way. God could have said, as the human population is flourishing, every morning I want them to come out, look up at the sky, and open their mouth, and I will drop little flakes of manna in. Periodically, I'll spice it up with a little quail or water from rocks just to kind of keep the diet going. But God didn't do that. No, what God did, he said, I will make human beings capable of pooling their resources, that's called capital, capable of designing an oven, innovation, mixing and baking the bread, operations, putting it on trucks, supply chain, and taking it out and feeding a hungry world. When Martin Luther says that when you and I do our work, we become the hands of God, feeding and caring for the world he wants, and that is kingdom work. And there is no institution in our world as it is currently constituted in this 21st century global economy that is better able to deliver on that than business. Business is particularly well suited to combine resources and direct them in a way that will produce goods and services that will enable the community to flourish. And that's why I think it makes God's mission statement. That's the first purpose. Now, there's a second. So far, I've been talking about work that's done in the garden and its importance because of its product. But there's another reason that work in the garden is important. Work in the garden is seen as part of God's very initial design of the whole place. Adam and Eve were designed in part to be workers. If they were to express their very essence, in part of that expression has to be work. We're told that Adam and Eve were made in the image of God. And theologians have debated for a long time what that means and to what extent can the creature carry the glory of the Creator. But in a very sort of simple-minded way, if you just start at the beginning of Genesis and read down to like verse 26 where it talks about the image of God, we don't know very much about God up to that point except this. He's a worker. He made heavens. He made earth. He set the water going. He turned the lights on. He populated the lands. God says he worked for 6 days and then he rested. And when Adam and Eve are made in the image of God, they are made at least in part to be workers. Now, think how different that is than our modern cultural understanding of work. In general, we perceive of work as a disutility. From an employer standpoint, it's a cost. Labor is a cost. From an employee standpoint, if I can make the same amount of money and cut my hours back, hey, that's the way to go. Because every hour I save is a step in the right direction. But that's so contrary to God's picture. God says that work is a way in which they express their very identity. It's part of his creator. It's the order that he looks at and says, that's good. That's very good. Now, not all work brings forth this humanizing, all that we were meant to be kind of activity. In fact, much work is dehumanizing. There was a famous quote that I'm sure many of you have heard. Henry Ford once said, why is it that when I only want to hire a pair of hands, I always get the whole person? And there are many businesses in our world today that are still just hiring pairs of hands and interchangeable pairs of hands at that in a way that degrades the human condition. If the work that we are to do is to enable us to express our identity in the image of God, then it has to be work that in some sense bears hints or mirrors the kind of work God did. And what do we know about that? Well, when God did his work, the product that it produced was good. And so when we give people work to do, it needs to be work that has the capacity to deliver good, has to have the potential for significance, for meaning. We know that God's work was creative. He creates the heavens and the earth. So when we deliver, when we give jobs, they need to have hints of creativity. But if we can give jobs that have meaning with hints of creativity, we enable people to express their identity, their God-given identity, through their work. And this, then, I think, makes the purpose statement. That is, the purpose of business is to provide goods and services that will enable the community to flourish and to provide jobs in a way that really in this day and age, business is again best suited to deliver, to provide jobs that will enable individuals to express their God-given creativity or God-given identity through meaningful and creative work. Now, so far in this hurried tour, we've only been looking at the creation movement. That's only two chapters of the Bible. It seems like a very reasonable question to say, what about all the rest? Does that not change the purpose? And I don't feel like I have enough time to fully answer that, but let me suggest that my short answer is no. The rest of the story does not change the purpose, although it does affect the activities that business is called to do. And to help you see that, let me give you a little story. Imagine that instead of creating the world, God created a sailboat. And he said, I'm going to put you on the sailboat, and I want you to sail to the islands. And you get to do the creative work of figuring out the course. You get to do the scientific work of studying the currents. You get to do the manual work of raising the sails. But I'm going with you. I'm going to be the wind that blows the sail, and we're going to sail to the islands. Now imagine you get to the marina, and you climb onto the boat, and you discover that through your own negligence or disobedience, your boat is trashed. There is a hole in the hull. I've been practicing that all week. A hole in the hull. The sail is ripped. That's the fall. Now, has God's purpose changed? Nope. God still wants to sail to the islands. Is what you have to do in order to live out that purpose changed? Yeah, a little bit. You still have to do all of that forward kind of activity, but now you also have to do repair activity. You have to sew up the sails. You have to patch the holes. You have to restore the boat. And that's redemptive work. That's the work in theological terms that we speak of in terms of reconciliation and redemption. And we get, as business people, the opportunity to participate in that work. Their new activities get added to our plate because of the fall and because of our opportunity to participate in redemption and reconciliation, but it doesn't change the purpose. We're still sailing to the islands. We're still trying to produce goods and services and jobs that will enable the community to flourish. It just means now it is appropriate for business to pay attention to things like AIDS and global degradation and poverty and oppression and the fact that many people have never heard of the name of Jesus Christ. These kinds of things now seem appropriate subjects for the business to pay attention to because they are things that stand in the way of the community flourishing. But business still is pursuing the same thing, enabling the community and their employees to flourish through this service. So that's my quick tour of the scriptural basis for my thinking here. The second question or critique that I often get is this: what about profit? Which I sometimes characterize as the "Ah, come on" critique. Ah, come on, Jeff! You're the dean of a business school, for crying out loud! You mean to tell me that in your school you don't talk about, you know, returns and efficiencies and profits? And the answer is, of course we do. We talk about all that stuff. We talk about it because it's important to help our students prepare to be effective in business. But here's the difference. We do not teach business profit as an end. We teach it as a means. And by that we mean profit is the means you need to attract the capital to enable the business to do what it is to do, which is to serve. Now, if you think about it, this picture turns the current paradigm upside down. The current paradigm will tell you this. It says, should I be good to my employees? Yeah, you should be good to your employees most of the time. Why? Because it will reduce turnover, it will increase retention, reduce your expenses, and leave more money to drive upstairs to the shareholders. Should I be straight with my customers? Yeah, you bet. Why? Well, it'll increase brand loyalty, drive sales, more revenues to shoot upstairs to the shareholders. That is, my employees, my customers become means to the end of serving my shareholders. This model says, let's turn it upside down. Let's use capital as a means of serving customers and employees. Now, when I shared this before, some folks have said to me, oh, Jeff, you have misunderstood. You are confusing a not-for-profit corporation whose purpose is to serve with a profit corporation whose purpose is to make money. And I say, no. You have confused the purpose and the strategy. I believe that not-for-profits and for-profits have the same purpose, which is to serve their community and to enable it to flourish. They often will speak to different segments of society. The real, though, way that they are different is they have different strategies. The not-for-profit gets the capital it needs by saying, could you please give me some? And the for-profit gets it by running a business that generates sufficient return to enable it to attract the capital that it needs. But that's the difference at the strategy level they both exist to serve. Here's another way to think of it. Think about it from a let's put it into a nonprofit situation. Supposing you went to a large not-for-profit, and you said to the large not-for-profit, find the executive director, say American Lung Association or something, and you said, why does your organization exist? Would it not strike you as a little weird if she answered, we exist to raise funds? No, they're not going to say, we exist to, promote scientific research or cure lung disease or something. Second question, what do you spend most of your time doing? Well, honestly, raising funds. Same thing is true for business. Why do you exist? We exist to serve, to enable the community to flourish, to enable our employees to have meaningful jobs. What do you spend most of your time doing? Honestly, we spend a lot of time paying attention to running a profitable business because it's not easy. Running a profitable business in today's world is hard work, and it takes a lot of time and attention, but it is not the end. So what is profit? Well, as I said, profit's not the end. I don't think profit's the reward for running a good business. Because there's, frankly, good businesses, businesses that serve, and sometimes that results in profits and sometimes it doesn't. I don't think it's a metric that measures whether you're doing your business right, because if the metric ought to be measuring your ultimate purpose. Here's what I would say profit is. Profit is one of a number of very important metrics. Perhaps in some sense for the health of your corporation, you could argue it's the most important measure, but it's not the ultimate test. It's not the ultimate goal. All it really measures is whether your company is efficiently responding to market requests. That's an important thing to do. It's a critical thing to do, but it's not the purpose. The purpose of business is to serve. The third question or critique I sometimes get is this. Jeff, aren't you a little far out there? I mean, you're actually talking about turning the dominant paradigm upside down. Aren't you sort of relegating us to the fringes? And honestly, when we started talking this kind of language about 5 years ago in the business school, I was quite nervous about this. The brand new dean going to take the school off to the margins. But in the last 5 years, there has been an enormous transformation that is sweeping through business. If you're not watching it, you're missing one of the great changes of our time. It's just astonishing how much is happening. And I'm talking about Christians in business, I'm just talking about business as a whole, is increasingly understanding its broader role in society. We had Blake Nordstrom, who was the CEO from Nordstrom, come in and speak to our students. He said, in the 90s, we lost our way. Why? Because we started focusing on profit. We then got healthy at the end of that decade. How do we do it? Because we started focusing on what we should have been focusing all along, serving our customers. You see, examples after examples, there's a book called Faith and Fortune, written by a guy named Mark Gunther, who's an editor for Fortune magazine. The subtitle under that book is A Quiet Revolution in Business, and I believe that is what's happening. I just see hints of it everywhere. I'll just give you two quotes. One is from the Harvard Business Review. I mean, somebody said the Harvard Business Review, not Sojourners or some left-wing thing, but Harvard Business Review. It's under the heading, What's a Business For? But to turn shareholders, this is the quote, but to turn shareholders' needs into a purpose is to be guilty of a logical confusion, to mistake a necessary condition for a sufficient one. We need to eat to live. Food is a necessary condition of life. But if we lived mainly to eat, making food a sufficient or sole purpose of life, we would become gross. The purpose of a business, in other words, is not to make a profit full stop. It is to make a profit so that the business can do something more or better. Just this year, McKinsey & Company, big international metric-driven, not a squishy group, comes out with its annual report, surveys C-level officers all around the world. Here's one of their key findings from this year's report. Unquestionably, the global business community has embraced the idea that it plays a wider role in society. More than 4 out of 5 respondents agree that generating high returns for investors should be accompanied by a broader contribution to the public good. For example, providing good jobs, making philanthropic donations, going beyond legal requirements to minimize pollution and other negative effects of business. This is broad-based movement across the business field. This presents an incredible opportunity for Christians. In the same report that McKinsey delivers, in which these 4 out of 5 say, yes, we have this broader role, they also report, we don't know how to do it. It kind of scares us. What an opportunity for Christians in business who have understood God's purposes to step in and provide leadership, not just for Christians in business, but for the industry as a whole, as a possibility of reshaping the way our world looks like. It's a great time to be a Christian in business. Fourth and last critique. Jeff, can this really work in a free market economy? I mean, I hear you talk about business as service and it makes me feel all warm and gooey inside, but doggone, I got to go back and run a business on the ground against people who are manically focused on squeezing out the every last dollar. How could I possibly compete unless I play their game? Right, but not always. The invisible hand of Adam Smith is not the hand of God. His hand points to a very, very miraculously efficient allocation of resources in response to market signals. That's really good, but it's not the same thing as shalom. It's not peace and justice and harmony. And as a result, one ought to expect that there will be sometimes, and we could debate how often, but sometimes when the hands point in opposite directions. And if that means, in those cases, if you're going to be a Christian who follows after Christ, it may work to your disadvantage in the marketplace. We like to say good ethics is good business. And I think it is, most of the time, but not all the time. Because if it was always true, we wouldn't even teach business ethics at business schools. We would just have a second section on strategy. Okay? It would be, ethics would just be a tool to get someplace. So, not always does it work to your benefit. However, that's the caveat. Now, in this particular time, in this particular era, it strikes me that these alternate understandings of purpose are likely to be very competitive in the marketplace. Why? Well, there's several reasons, but let me just focus on one. One is because a great deal of the wealth of corporations these days is tied up in the intellectual and creative capacity of employees. Some people recommend or suggest that it's as much as 50% of the wealth of corporations is in their intellectual and creative capacities of the employees, things that don't show up on the balance sheet. If you want to unleash that, one of the keys to teach, what we teach in leadership now, is to find ways to connect your employees' broader aspirations to what you need them to do to advance the business. You need to look for something bigger than just the company itself. Jeff Immelt from GE says this. He says, to be a great company today, you also have to be a good company. The reason that people come to work for GE is that they want to be about something that is bigger than themselves. They want to work for a company that makes a difference, a company that's doing great things in the world. I mean, think about the alternative. Imagine that you brought your workforce together Monday morning, and you bring them into the conference room, they sit around the conference table, and you say to them, today I want you to go out and leave it all on the floor. I want every last creative juice you've got. I want all of your intellectual capacity brought to bear. If you're in Seattle and it's Monday morning, it's wet, it's gray, and you have some employee yawning, raises his hand, and he says, why? And you say, so we can maximize the return to the shareholders. It's just not very inspiring. Jim Collins has written a couple of books. Good to Great, I suspect, is familiar to many of you. The earlier one, Built to Last, same methodology in a variety of industries, about 12 different industries or so. He looks at two companies, each industry. One he calls a good company based on long-term solid financial performance. The other he calls a great company based on spectacular financial performance. And then he stands back and looks and says, how can you distinguish between these two? That is, across industries, what distinguishes great from good? And he comes up with a handful of characteristics, but here's one of them. The great companies, he says, never focus on profit. They never identify it as their goal. They never talk very much about it. The great companies focus on their mission. Now, all companies these days, virtually all, have mission statements, but for many of them, it's things you hang on the wall. But for the great companies, not only are the mission statements great, but they run the organization. I mean, let me just read you a couple that he quotes. One from, say, Sony. Sony's mission is this: to establish a place of work where engineers can feel the joy of technological innovation, be aware of their mission to society, and work to their heart's content. My favorite is Johnson & Johnson. It's a short one. This company exists to alleviate pain and suffering. That kind of gets you up in the morning, wouldn't it? What are you going to do today at work, honey? Well, I'm going to go alleviate pain and suffering. The idea is you find a mission that can capture the imagination of the employees. This is a personal thing for me, and I'll just end with this story. It's a personal thing because for about 2 decades before I became the dean of the business school, I was in private practice of law. I came out of law school and interviewed with a number of different firms, and truthfully, from an applicant standpoint, they all looked the same. They kept trying to stress each one how cool they were, and we work hard and we play hard, or we do cutting-edge work, but they all said that. So from a standpoint of an applicant, you couldn't tell any difference. Until I came to one company. This company said to me, we're different, and I'll tell you 2 reasons. First, our partners have voluntarily chosen to work less and make less money. And they pass that on down to the associates as well. We have no billable hour goals. We don't circulate billable hours. We're very different that way. In modern day parlance, this would be a firm that was paying a lot of attention to work-life balance. Well, they didn't talk in those terms then. Second thing he said to me was, this firm is very behind people doing pro bono work, work for free. Now, all firms will tell you they support pro bono work. But what most firms mean by that is after you've given me your minimum 1,800, 2,000, 2,200 billable hours, when it is essentially your free time, if you want to help a poor person, feel free to use our letterhead. Okay? But this firm was different. This firm said, no, you could take up to a quarter of your time working for people that can't pay our fees. I'll tell you why. Because we believe in justice, and we believe it's not justice unless people can get it, even if when they can't afford it. And I said, wow, this is a place I can give myself to. And so I went to work there, and I worked there for 20-plus years. But during my time there, I was, for a good part of that time, in management, and I say that only to set up the next statement. The firm, over that 20 years, made a number of small, incremental decisions, the cumulative effect of which was, by the time I came to the end of my time with them, I concluded that it was a great, great firm, like all the other great, great firms. And I was working harder than I had ever worked, and I was sitting there saying, why am I doing this? What is this for? And the only 2 answers I could come with is so that I can continue to have neat little puzzles to play with at the cutting edge of my field, and I could make more money. And it just wasn't enough. It didn't get me up anymore. And then the opportunity came to go to work with the business school. And part of the reason that I did this is because as the dean, I get the privilege of working with faculty and students. And it's my hope that if I can take just a handful, just if I can reach even a handful, so that they are not asking about business, how can I get as much out of this as I can? How can I maximize return? But rather can saying, how can I use this as a tool for God to serve the world? And if a few of those students get into some businesses, and if a few of those businesses survive and succeed in this global economy, then we might actually change the world. And I have a small part of that. And that still gets me up every day. I believe that business is an incredibly noble profession, a very high calling. I believe right now it's the most exciting time to be in business. We will, if we pursue business for the purpose of enabling, of serving our communities, to enable them to flourish, of serving our employees by helping them with jobs that are meaningful and creative, if we pursue those purposes, we will bring glory to our God in heaven, and we will advance His kingdom work here on earth. And that's an incredible privilege. Let me just end as I started to say again, what an incredible honor this is for me to have had this chance to talk with you. Thanks so much.